You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 17th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, no longer in the shadow, literally or metaphorically, of the New York Times. Just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Thomas Gagin, labor lawyer, author of over a dozen books, his latest, Only One Thing Can Save Us. Also on the program today, President Obama announces, or is, I think, literally announcing, that the U.S. is finally taking steps to normalize relationships with Cuba. So close to this embargo thing finally paying dividends. President Obama gives up on it. Also on the program today, more on Witness 40. The witness in the Michael Brown shooting grand jury, who supposedly testified, or in fact did testify, that Michael Brown was charging at Darren Wilson like a football player, had his head down like a football player, never had his hands up. Turns out, aside from having all sorts of issues with the police in the past, completely fabricated the whole thing. It's stunning, not so much that someone would fabricate this, but that someone would be allowed to testify to a grand jury without anyone given the opportunity to impeach their testimony. We will get to that story and more. Also on the program, an important Supreme Court case involving Amtrak. There's a reason why their on-time record has dropped dismally in the past year and a half. And James Risen, the Department of Justice not going to make him testify as to his source, but still wants him to testify. We shall see. All that and more on today's program, folks. So this Cuba announcement is happening, I believe, as we speak. And it does not appear on its face to be so, well, let me rephrase. I was going to say it doesn't appear to be as dramatic as one would think. It is dramatic. This has been 60-some-odd years in the making, 50-some-odd. It is not – the changes are not going to be dramatically felt by the U.S. population at this point. I think it's just a matter of time. This is finally – we've taken the first step. The U.S. interest section – it will become an embassy, and I think from there everything will follow. There will be most of the immediate changes seems to be a relaxation of existing restrictions on travel, but not a total relaxation. A higher amount of money that can be brought back into the country, a little bit more ease if you have family there, perhaps one or two more reasons in which you can apply for an OFAC license, for an Office of I gotta look up what that stands for. I have been through this process, having gone now, I guess it was about 14 years ago, 13 years ago, with Nikki, my wife, who was making a documentary in Cuba. We went down there with a crew, with under an OFAC license, you should know. And so we went through the whole process, and it was a laborious process. But I think the embassy opening is probably the biggest one. The intersection will turn into an embassy. There's already a large structure there in Havana. And like I say, they call it an intersection because they didn't have formal recognition. So these formal moves are going to be important, and it should be interesting to watch the freak out from people like Marco Rubio, although we'll also, I think, see it from Menendez. And I guess the real question is what does Ted Cruz's dad think about this? And we will check in later in the program. It's a tease.
Very, very bad. Very bad.
We will check in later in the program with Rafael
Mandela
Cruz.
Mandela may have some thoughts.
Oh, really? Yes. I mean, why wouldn't he? In fact, a generic Israeli guy might, too. We're going to bring out every polite Southern lady might and libertarian caller.
And why not Barack Obama himself?
That's right. We're
going to
have
policy.
A cavalcade of impressions will give their feelings on Cuba.
And Amber.
Later
and
in the program.
She will weigh in as well.
That's right.
The character Amber.
All right. We're going to take a break when we come back. Thomas Gagin. And a reminder, folks, it's your memberships that make this show possible. Join today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program American labor lawyer based in Chicago, author of over half a dozen books, including his latest, Only One Thing Can Save Us. Welcome to the program, Thomas Gagin.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for inviting me.
So I really enjoyed your book, and we just coincidentally had Stanley Aronowitz on the program last week, also talking about the labor movement. And so I want to it's interesting where some of your solutions, I think, in some way dovetail. But I want to start with what the question is: What are we? Do we need saving from at this point?
I would say that we need saving from the corruption of our character more than anything else. Now, you could put it in all sorts of different ways. Some people prefer to say we're going to lose the middle class, we're going to have an increase in inequality. All of that is true. We may have wages go up a little bit in the coming year, but that's like a kind of reversion to a mean, and the mean is dropping, dropping, dropping. During this period of dropping, 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 which could go on with the dollar's knobs up the way they are for decades, there'll be years where things go up, blip, and then they go back down. The long term, what economists call the secular long term trend, is that wages are flat, falling, while productivity increases. And let me, a statistic is just, you could pick one of a gazillion statistics, but from 2000 to 2012, the pay of the bottom 70% of Americans, if I can use that term, bottom 70% of Americans, was flat or falling even as productivity rose 7%. And if you look at a longer term, 79 to the present, the pay went up maybe average pay. A lot of people dropped, but average pay probably went up from 79 to the present about 5%. But productivity rose 75%. In other words, all this extra growth is going to the top. But here's what we need to be saved from. We need to be saved from this loss of our sense of citizenship, this loss of a sense of control over our lives. And that's why we need to have more control over what we do at work. Because if we have this kind of, if we take the bad habits that we're learning in a union-free world, in the workplace where we spend most of our working waking lives, learned helplessness, being disengaged, following orders, into a democratic society and expect that society to work, we're deluding ourselves. That's what we need saving from.
And I mean, there's a lot to unpack in all of that. And I guess it's all in some ways, I guess the loss of real wages is a manifestation or a byproduct of that dilemma where we have sort of lost our power as workers in the context of work and in our ability to have some measure of not necessarily self-determination, but of sort of broadly speaking, just broad determination, I guess, as to where we are going. And
let me put it in more graphic terms for young people who have really gotten slashed. I mean, these numbers look better than they should because we're talking about a baby boom generation that is higher skilled than the cohorts that are coming up behind us, partly because we're de-skilling work. That's one of the things that I'm arguing for in this, arguing about, making the case for in this book. Let's talk about young people. Their wages really are dropping. I mean, this isn't a case of stagnation compared to earnings of 20 to 30s, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. And they are in lower skilled jobs, and they are trapped in those jobs. And we have college graduates coming out with some with very high skills, degrees in biology and chemistry, who are working as temps for big companies like Abbott Labs and other places that we don't, it's not, Sam, that we don't have unions anymore. We don't even have employers. I mean, so imagine a world in which people are so isolated with nobody mentoring them, with no employment relationship that's real from day to day. We're all heading into a kind of temp category, or at least younger people are. With nobody to watch their backs, nobody to watch out for them. I mean, it's a formula for a really unpleasant future.
I mean, it's interesting.
I don't want to say dystopian, but it's very bleak.
Yeah, I mean,
compared to what people used to have. And when you see these polls that people don't trust institutions, especially young people don't trust institutions, there aren't any institutions out there that watch their backs, that protect them, that look out for them. There isn't the union guy or even a supervisor at work, because you don't have employers anymore who will say, don't do that, kid. Watch out for that. Don't take this dope and expect to pass the drug test. You know, that kind of thing. It's just disappearing as people are just put out there on their own. That's what's really dangerous.
I just want to be clear on that dynamic where you have basically, I don't know what the technical term for this is, insourcing, outsourcing. It's outsourcing, I guess, a labor force, but not necessarily internationally outsourcing it. Just instead of you dealing with having to hire and have human resources in your company, you just hire another company to do all the hiring. And so there's nobody in the company. What you're saying is that, hey, I had your job 25 years ago, and this is the way that I worked my way through this company, et cetera, et cetera. It is just a bunch of disparate people just sort of floating through. It's almost sort of the next step when you have a conveyor belt going from artisans to, I guess, conveyor belts in factories. This is the next step of alienation.
Very well. I mean, there aren't classifications anymore. You don't work at developing a skill, so you're pushed up to a higher classification. You're a temp forever. We're all at entry level forever. I'm trying in this book to contrast the reality, and this is, as you know, Sam, because you've read the book, this is just kind of a small part of it, really. But in one part of the book, I'm trying to contrast this reality where we aren't doing more to invest in younger, middle-aged workers, skill them up, against this kind of bogus rhetoric that, yes, we're looking for higher qualifications all the time, and this is a world in which we need more and more job training and this and that and the other thing. That's the official Chamber of Commerce, Kiwanis Club, Democratic Party, Republican Party, not so much Republican Party, refreshingly, Democratic Party blather. But the reality is that there's no interest in doing that. Yeah, you know, the interest is in making people as powerless as possible, certainly to have a kind of, you know, managerial group that watches over them and sort of passes them along. But the managers don't know that much about the work production process either. They came out of, you know, X, Y, and Z business school and, you know, never, as my mother used to say about some other women she knows, she never soiled a dish, you know, and they never did any work on the production line. So
let's talk.
And of course, the United States is notorious for getting rid of manufacturing. You know, how often do I hear people tell me, oh, well, this is, you know, it's, we're moving into an employee-free world and it's manufacturing, you don't understand. Hey, you know, does anybody in this country have a clue as to what's going on in other countries? It's not. We have 9% of our workforce in manufacturing. Germany, which is paying higher wages than we do, has 25% of their workforce in manufacturing. We have about 12% of our GDP coming out of manufacturing. Germany has 25%. What's the reason for that? The reason for that, I go into it in this book in some detail, is you can just make a lot more money with financial instruments in this country than you can in making durable goods. And as you know, I spent a whole chapter talking about Keynes's concern.
Yes.
In the general theory, this is John Maynard Keynes, arguing in the 1930s, you can't run a trade deficit. You know, we're high-fiving ourselves because we brought our trade deficit down a little bit thanks to oil. But our merchandise trade deficit has been going up, and we are still running the world's biggest whopping trade deficit, even as we congratulate ourselves on how it's been dropping. It hasn't dropped nearly enough. And the reason for that, or Keynes would say, what's the reason for that? Keynes would say, Well, you're allowing too much of your investment to go in the financial sector and not into the into durable goods.
And he was saying this
quaint, but it's exactly the truth.
And he was saying this 80 years ago or some odd when, as opposed to now, when the percentage of our economy is far more dominated by finance than it was at that time.
And a lot of our Keynesian economists here don't pick up on that. And one of the points of the book is, if you're a Keynesian or want to be a Keynesian, why don't you read the whole book, General Theory? Because there's a part two in it where he talks about it's not only important to keep up aggregate demand, which, by the way, is harder and harder to do because wages are too low. And one of the things that Keynes says in the book that's really salient and applicable now is that it's hard to keep up aggregate demand if you've got wages set too low. That's why the government comes in and has to pump things up. But the fundamental problem is that the government comes in and pumps things up with the notion that somehow or another that's going to raise aggregate demand again and solve this problem that led Keynes to write the book. But if aggregate demand, if wages don't go up, you're just locked into this kind of stagnation forever. And I think if he were alive today, he'd be pointing that out to us. But the other part of Keynes that people don't focus on is his waving his arms throughout this book, and especially towards the end, and saying, you can't run a trade deficit. And that's exactly what we're doing, kind of uniquely among high-wage countries. There are a lot of other high-wage countries that aren't running trade deficits the way we are. We're unique. And it's not because of NAFTA, and it's not because of the Pacific Trade Agreement or anything else. It's because we have all the dials and knobs set in this country to invest in finance and to invest in low-wage jobs because we let wages be really low.
Let's talk about this finance thing for a bit more, because ultimately the only thing that can save us is this a return to a new kind of labor movement, as you just basically restate the title. But one of the things that strikes me too, and I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit, was that not only do we have a problem where we have so much money tied up in finance in this country as opposed to manufacturing, but we also have a problem, and this, you know, like I said, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I want to address this. We also have a problem where it seems to me where a lot of our corporate governance has turned these corporations into financial instruments in and of themselves for people like the CEO and the board of directors. Bill Lozonik out of UMass has done a lot of work on this, where the change in compensation in the 70s and 80s, or particularly the early 80s, to where you had CEOs and board of directors getting stock options, and they did this because they were getting favorable tax treatment with Reagan, basically turned the CEOs basically had a cottage industry, which was basically a side bet on their own company. And so investing in their own companies, dealing with a labor force, all those things became secondary to raising the value of their stocks, which was essentially where their compensation came from anyway. So it wasn't the actual performance of the company, the long-term prospects of the company, but rather how it did in terms of their stock portfolio. And that has fundamentally shifted the governance of these corporations.
The stockholders, these CEOs are no longer accountable to stockholders. And there's something anachronistic about the Dodd-Frank approach, which is to try to put back in place something that's been broken irrevocably, which is the old stockholder model. I don't think Dodd-Frank does a very good job of doing that. It's just little baby steps. But as we move to these mutual funds, and there's some stuff in the news now that some of the mutual funds like Vanguard are going to try to be more conscientious about good government of the companies they invest in. But, you know, I'm skeptical that anything will come of it. That's been said off and on at different times by different funds over the years. The problem is that there's no accountability for the for-profit companies. Just as, by the way, there's no accountability at all for these huge not-for-profits, the medical centers, the universities, that are supposed to have these charitable missions that nobody really enforces anymore, and the boards are self-perpetuating. So you start to see not only these huge paydays in the for-profit sector, because there's nobody to stop it, no stockholder control, but huge paydays in the not-for-profit sector. But let me make – I'm not going to defend the way – and you stated it very well, that that corporations themselves become financial instruments because you use corporate cash to bid up the stock price, which bids up the CEO salaries, et cetera, et cetera. It's all pernicious, I agree. But let me say something in their defense. They are sitting on piles of cash, and they aren't investing. But it's hard to make a case for them to invest as much as they should when aggregate demand is so low. And aggregate demand is so low is because we have a dysfunctional labor model. We aren't paying people enough. So how does the labor movement help in this? Number one, you know, push up aggregate demand. Number two, a new kind of labor movement, not resuscitating the old organized labor, which is banging on the outside for higher wages, but a new kind of labor movement, more like the European labor movements, where you is what we need here to put in place a stakeholder model. And by that, I mean specifically a system where you have employees electing some, not all, not the majority, not necessarily half and half like in Germany, but maybe more like in Belgium and other countries, where you're electing maybe a third of the directors of the board, so that there's somebody in the room that can look the other directors in the eye and say, hey, we're here, and push corporations to have some accountability, at least to the people who are giving career-length service to them. So, of course, if the corporation is hiring only temps, you could say nobody's giving career-length service to it anymore. But that's the ideal.
And that sounds great to me, but from the perspective of the CEO and the board of directors who are saying, like, okay, and I take your point that there isn't anything for them to necessarily invest in if they don't anticipate any demand, but it doesn't seem to me that that is the primary force. What seems to me the primary force is that these board of directors and the CEO knows, look, if I do a stock buyback, this is going to push up my compensation directly. I mean, it's irrelevant. You know, demand is all good and profits are all good, but there's another way to get profit, higher profit margin. That's to me to cut my labor force.
Yeah, I agree with that. But you know, the world's complicated, and there are lots of different aspects and variables to this, and not everybody in the corporate world is a thief. I would just say that. That's one problem that has to be addressed, but it has to be addressed with these other problems as well. I mean, what we're trying to do, there's always peer pressure to some extent. You know, if you can, how should I say it? If you bring back a labor movement that is capable of at least sustaining aggregate demand in an adequate way, and you bring back a labor movement where people have more control over what they say and do at work, and if you bring back a labor movement that is able to provide some way of mobilizing people back into the political process, which is what labor is so used to be so great at doing, and now we have voter turnout rates of 37% in midterms and so forth, and put back in place things like interest rate caps and things like that. And if you have a labor movement, and I talk about ways in which you might start moving towards co-determination even now at the state level through state-level actions, that could get some bigger voice within the corporations. We have to press on all those things simultaneously. Even though they're all very complicated to do, we have to do them all at once. And that's the agenda that I'm trying to lay out in this book and trying to explain how we can do them all at once, that it's not hopeless, and that there are really possible ways out of this gridlocked, dysfunctional shareholder model, a dysfunctional labor representation model. And I, as you know, I go into that in quite some detail as to why our system of exclusive representation, which is the hallmark of the American-style labor movement, doesn't work anymore.
Yes, I want to get in.
And our dysfunctional gridlock political model. We have to fix them all at once. But bringing back the labor movement is key to working on all three of those
I want to get into that because that's I think that's that is interesting, and it's something that I've been hearing quite a bit about, the idea of I've heard different people say it in different ways, minority representation. I mean, basically sort of what we're seeing at this Volkswagen plant in Tennessee that failed to organize, I guess it was about a year ago. But before we get to there, I just want to get to just – I also want to touch on because – get back to the education thing, because one thing that strikes me in your criticism of the Democratic Party and just sort of, I guess, the liberal left in espousing education as a panacea for what ails us in that labor sector is this. A lot of educators basically say to me that, you know, we've got it backwards. The things that are inhibiting education output are the things that we are prescribing education to fix. Can you just talk about just the fallacy of why we need a sort of a more educated labor force? You touched on it briefly, but could you just go into that a little bit more?
Well, I feel odd saying this, Sam, because on the one hand, people have picked up this book and said, you're talking about the fallacy of education. You know, as I said in the book, I think we need more education, but it's a different kind of education than we're pushing. So, I mean, the obvious, maybe too obvious point, which is starting to come out now, is that we have expanded college education dramatically, and it's done nothing to bring down inequality in the country. And we do have even a growing number of college grads, not just in debt, but stuck in non-college jobs, something like 20%. And the college jobs aren't paying more. Of course, there are exceptions, but if you pare down those exceptions, you're looking at people who have elite educations, postgraduate educations, not college BAs. And the notion that more and more education is going to save us in a system that is pushing people more and more into entry level. I mean, the people who are temps are college grads, right? It's just a profound disconnect. And the party, and by the party, I mean the Democratic Party, the leadership in D.C., is faintly beginning to understand that this isn't quite right, their message, but they still haven't gotten it. Obama's famous Potawatomi speech is where he talked about inequality. It's eloquent. You know, quotes Theodore Roosevelt and the people back at the progressives at the turn of the century and this and that and the other thing, and it says all the right things. And then at the end, he gets to the solution. Well, what's the solution? It's put more people into college. First of all, it's so insulting to demoralizing to the base of the Democratic Party. Most people in this country are high school graduates. You know, it's only like 30% of adult Americans, 24 to 65, who have college degrees. That means 70% don't. That means that the Democratic Party is telling lower income, lower skilled people, there's no hope for you.
Right.
And you can imagine how white males react to that, just with fury. Black males, African-American males, Latino males, not so much with so much fury. They've got no place to go except the Democratic Party, because the answer of the white males is to go after the minority race males. But it kind of writes off everybody. It's like, hey, it's too late for you. You know, maybe we can do something for your kids, which they no longer believe at some level. So there are two.
It also deflects.
Either they believe this, that it's too late for them, in which case they're mad at the Democratic Party, or they don't believe it. that it's too late for them, in which case they're mad at the Democratic Party. You know, I mean, it's just the worst possible message to be to offer as the solution to raising your standard of living in this country.
And it's also a poor policy prescription. It's a way of sort of deflecting from what is sort of systemically problematic. It's not, you know, like you say, it's not a lack of education. All right, so let's talk about what does a new labor movement look like? And also talk about what I know that you feel that most people don't realize about the power that they have still under the National Labor Relations Act. You know, there's in terms of striking.
Well, a new labor movement would be one which is number one. It focuses much more on democracy of the workplace. Number two, it unleashes people to control their own labor movement. Number three, gives up this principle of exclusive representation in order to make the labor movement more militant than it is. And let me go back and talk about more democracy in the workplace. The great need is to pick up habits of citizenship where we spend our waking lives in the workplace. And I'm really big on pushing sort of what the Germans and other Northern Europeans are doing, works councils that everybody in the plan elects that have real statutory rights, control over in setting the schedules, how the place works, and getting information from corporate records and so forth, and being really part of the governing structure of the company. In that respect, I talk about various ways of pushing both co-determination and works councils. I also want to emphasize how important it is to move to a Civil Rights Act model of enforcing labor rights instead of this old NLRB model, that is amending the Civil Rights Act or having a separate Civil Rights Act for labor so that people could go out, get their own lawyers, bring their own cases in court, not depend on union lawyers like me or being paid a certain amount, have those lawyers go, and when people are fired or harassed on the job for their support of a union in a way that's unlawful, go in for the kind of remedies that you can get under the Civil Rights Act, preliminary injunctions, punitive damages, but most of all, discovery. Discovery, discovery, discovery is what changes behavior of corporations, you know, rifling through their files, poking through their house, so to speak, deposing their CEOs. None of that can happen now under the existing model. And if you expand the civil rights model to protect people's right to be union members, that would have a huge impact on corporate behavior, just as the civil rights laws have had a huge impact on corporate behavior.
Is that a model, or is that a system that is sort of statutory?
It's a model and statutory, of course. I mean, it's a paradigm.
Do we need to rely on changes in the National Labor Relations Act to get
a law?
Yeah,
so
a law.
Yeah, that brings up the need to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, gerrymandering of the U.S. House. And you may say, well, that's not going to happen now. No, it's not going to happen right now. But you also, it's time for people on the left to start playing the long game. I mean, in the end, what we want over the next 10 years is the Civil Rights Act for labor. But in the meantime, and here, as you point out, Sam, I spent a lot of time talking about the UAW engagement with Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, dear to my heart because I wrote a book about Germany and German works councils, and here the whole thing has come to America, and there's a kind of a rich irony in the fact that while globalization may have hurt the United States in particular because it is such a low-wage country and it doesn't, you know, pump up wages and skills to compete globally the way we should, that in a perverse way globalization may end up saving us because we do have rich countries, whether it's Germany, Japan, Sweden even, coming here and setting up shop in places like the South And we finally had a union. The United Auto Workers go in, work with the workers back in the home country, and confront these employers and say, why don't you act towards us here the way you do back in the home country, and not just in the home country. You know, Volkswagen has something like 27 plants in 27 different countries around the world, 27 different countries. In 25 of those countries, Volkswagen has a system that's like the German system in various ways, to various degrees. There's a works council, workers are represented, blah, 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 blah. 25 of the 27. Guess which two they don't? One is China, the other is the United States.
Right.
And one day they'll have it in China. You know, it's...
So, Tom, explain this.
Somebody woke up here and said, hey, why don't we have the same thing here?
Well, explain to me how, because there's two things that are happening there. There's one, we're seeing that type of work with the management. Two, we're also seeing, and this is particularly, well, I mean, it's less relevant because we're talking about a private union, but this notion of minority representation or lack of exclusive representation. In other words, only about 45% of the workers in Tennessee working for Volkswagen are represented by the union.
But Volkswagen is talking to them.
Right, exactly. And now was this because – my sense from afar has been that Volkswagen wanted to get into this relationship because they found it to be profitable and functionable and advantageous in their other companies. Or was it that the workers got the international unions to put pressure on Volkswagen?
Well, the national unions. First of all, talking about Volkswagen is complicated because – it does have works councils, and it does have co-determination. So you're talking about a company that has unionism built into it to a certain degree. Now, not that the labor people run it. They don't. But they, they have very powerful friends in high places in Volkswagen, people who came up through the unions and the works councils are part of the corporate structure of Volkswagen. So you know, it's a little hard for Americans to get their minds around it because it's not like our kind of business corporation. It's pluralistic. I mean, there are, you know, pro-union factions within Volkswagen. Let's put it that way.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is,
it's a real company, and there are factions that are anti-union, and it's not that Volkswagen thinks this is a good deal for America or that it's so nice. It's just got pressures within its own company to have this model replicated in other countries.
Well, so how do we replicate it in other companies? I mean, that's, I guess, the question is, like, is this something that is just so unique to Volkswagen that it really doesn't have any lesson for the way that unions interact with companies, outside of Volkswagen in this country?
That's a good question. And I would say that Volkswagen is certainly one of the German global companies that is bigger on this, but I think where Volkswagen goes, other companies are going. I mean, it's not that different with Daimler-Benz and BMW. What's been different now is that the UAW has been mobilizing not just the unions in Germany, although that's a big deal, that's a big part of it, but the unions in other countries where these corporate giants have gone. And if you are just focusing on Northern European companies alone, that in itself is quite something. You know, if that model gets introduced here into the United States just from those companies, which is what I suggest could happen here, very much could happen here, that creates a kind of alternative model that other Americans, because it's now on our shore, can see. It's like,
right.
You're the Spanish conquistadors, and you bring over microbes and plants and other things, and they start to fertilize and spread in the new world. I mean, it's kind of a weird analogy, but it's a new, how shall I say it? It's a new plant in the new world. At plants, and of all places, the non-union Dixie South. If you see a situation, if the white males and females who are voting in the South for Republicans start seeing a system where the union doesn't control the works councils. They don't have to be in the union. It's voluntary. On the other hand, they have all these rights to run the place. It starts to get the message across that labor is not something that's being imposed on people from outside, but there is a huge adversarial relationship with companies, but something that makes sense and empowers them. I hate that word empowers, but let's use it because I can't think of anything else. And it becomes very attractive. If it happens at Volkswagen, if it happens at Nissan, if it happens at BMW, why not other places?
You right. know,
and one of the reasons that people like the Tennessee governor and the senator Bob Corker, you know, are so fanatic about stopping Volkswagen from doing this is that they don't want anybody else to see it, and that's what we should be focusing on right now, putting in place things that people can see in their own backyard as alternatives to the kind of lives that are being dictated for them. You know, this is a lot better than spending your life as a temp, being on a works council or serving on a corporate board.
We've gone long here, but I still, if you don't mind, if you have a couple more minutes, I just want to ask you about the other sort of movement that we're seeing, the other sort of, I guess, new or semi-new paradigm, or maybe it's a return to an old paradigm we're seeing with the fast food workers around the country, people who are not in a formal union, who are exercising their ability to walk off the job for an hour or two or for a couple hours and then come back on. I mean, talk about why that's so powerful, and also your perspective on the raising of the minimum wage. I know that you are obviously in support of it, but you see it as not the sort of panacea that I think some people see it as.
No, I don't. Which one do you want me to go first on?
Whatever.
You know, one of the things people have forgotten over the years is, and it's hard to keep it in your head, I admit. In the United States, an employer can fire you for any reason, for any time, for the color of your tie, for doing good work. You know, they can bring you in and say, Sam, you are the best who's ever been, but you're fired. Why? I don't know. I just decided to do it.
And I've gotten fired multiple times that way, I should say.
But if you work as a a $9 an hour employee at Starbucks and you walk out in the morning rush hour when the line is out the door and down the block with two other employees and just say, we're going to go out for 15 or 20 minutes because we're really mad that you haven't been scheduling us in the way that would make sense of our very difficult lives and given us consistent schedules. And you create this huge disruption and just ruin everything, they can't fire you. You know, so it's a pretty bizarre legal system, but they can't fire you. Because why? Because Section 7 of the Wagner Act says that you have a right to engage in concerted activity. If you go out on your own with nobody with you, yes, you can be fired. If you go out with one other person, you can't be fired. And because then you're acting in concert with a fellow employee about working conditions.
Both my producers are looking at each other right now in a way that's making me a little bit concerned. But
oh, well, Sam, just get somebody to walk out with you. That's all you have to do.
Right.
I forgot the second part of your question.
Well, the second part was about the minimum wage and why this is
minimum wage. Of course I'm in favor of raising the minimum wage. I can't think of a better cause in the world. On the other hand, it's sort of like two cheers, maybe two and a half cheers, maybe 2.9 cheers. But it's not completely three cheers, because to the extent that you are using local governments as substitutes for a labor movement, you are really accommodating people's helplessness. And one of the great things about Fight for 15 is that at least some people are walking out. And that is creating pressure on local governments. But it's no substitute for a labor movement that protects people from being jerked around at work. And it's no substitute for the kind of broader corporate democracy that I'm talking about that might exist in Europe. And I have to say, it doesn't exist very much in the low wage world. And it's especially alarming if this labor movement to the extent that there are worker opportunity centers that are spreading, if they're just being funded by foundations and not by the labor movement itself, that's very disturbing. One day the money will run out. So it's great. It's maybe not so great to the extent that it accommodates a system where people don't have any power and have to rely upon government to step in and put up these floors and minimums. And given how much, when you look at the minimum wage, what is shocking is the amount of non-compliance with it, even with the minimum wage laws that exist. And I'm not talking about the South where it's just out of control or red states. I'm talking about blue states like California, New York. There was just a study done that something like some figure 10 to 20% of the employers just don't bother with it. It's not just that we have to get government to stop wage theft, get government to have minimum wage. We need to be in a world where it doesn't even cross the employer's mind to do that. And that requires putting a labor movement in place.
So broadly speaking, I mean, to wrap this up, that dynamic that you're talking about, where obviously it's important that people get a living wage, and $15 an hour is barely even there, frankly, relative to productivity and inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But that it has the effect, it seems to me, from your perspective, to the extent that there's ambivalence there, it has the effect of not putting labor in a position of having to basically get there on their own, which decreases their power in other sectors or other aspects of what they should be doing. And I wonder if that isn't the overall sort of – or one of the overall problems with or accounts for the lack of a genuine labor movement in this country, if it isn't on some level that – what organized labor has been seeking has become so narrow in some respects, and part of that is because there isn't the level of deprivation that we saw in the 1920s that, you know, you weren't organizing may have been a little bit more natural when it was a question of, like, if I go into work today, there's a decent chance that I could die.
Well, I understand that. So people aren't in the backyard shooting squirrels when they're unemployed because we now have unemployment insurance, and we have all these things that the Keynesian Revolution, the rise of the CIO, the New Deal, and just common sense put in place, and all sorts of floors. Yes, of course, and people aren't starving, and middle-class life, we are at a higher level of GDP per capita, and people live a lot better, diet and everything else, than they did in the 1930s. So all of that is true. On the other hand, people are more powerless than they were then. And there's one phenomenon that didn't exist back then. You know, if the 1920s and then 19 and the Gilded Age is one thing, but in the 1950s, 1960s, and when I went to college in 1967 and took Economics 1, they were still teaching it. You know, wages went up with productivity, roughly. Sometimes it went up ahead of productivity, and then you had inflation. But there's no connection anymore between what people are giving and what they're getting back. And there's that's in a way, people in that sense are being treated as they were in the Gilded Age in the 1920s. I quote one professor who said, you know, I used to think that the Gini index, that's the inequality index in the United States, was reaching the Gilded Age. He said, now I think it's back in the Middle Ages. And this is kind of a moderate centrist guy at Harvard University. In some ways, we're more deprived now. And to the extent that you see cops that were there that have gone, it's very disturbing. I came out of law school hoping and expecting to be kind of an ERISA lawyer. ERISA is Employee Retirement Income Security Act. It's a pension law. But there are no pension plans anymore because the premise of the law was that there would be these private pension plans because unions would bargain for them. But what they didn't figure on was that there wouldn't be any unions anymore. So,
and in fact, in the Cromnibus, we just saw an ability basically to renege on a lot of those promises.
Yeah, all these income stats about, you know, wages flat or falling are misstated to the extent that they leave out the fact that for millions and millions and millions and millions of workers, they've seen their health plans disappear, the deductibles go up to the roof to $5,000 a family, and no pension plan, gone. That's a huge drop in your standard of living. And so, yes, we're better off, and yes, we're deprived in ways that you know, have been unknown in this country since the 1920s.
Thomas Gagin, the book is The Only Thing That Can Save Us, Why America Needs a New Kind of Labor Movement. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Sure. Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. The Cuomo administration has just banned fracking in New York State due to health risk. Wow.
Looks like somebody's owed.
Wow, that's great news. That's really great news. And not – I don't know if that was expected. I think there was a lot of questions about it. There had been a moratorium for an extended period of time. There was a lot of political pushback on that. Many people – when I talk to people who were involved in the Teach Out campaign and people around that, there are basically two things that I hear that really drove her vote. And that was education issues and fracking. The anti-fracking folks in New York State, very, very well organized. We've talked to Josh Fox on this program multiple times over the years. And they were very, very on it. And I think Cuomo finally, after he got over his temper tantrums, probably sat down with a bunch of numbers from that last election, and God knows how he makes his calculations, but he clearly saw, like, this seems to be a no-brainer. If I want to be considered better than my daddy, I've got to do this. And then what I can do is go out and destroy public education. One for me, one for them. But I don't want to be well, yes, I do.
Yeah, you
do. I was going to say, like, you know what? I should be, you know, but F Cuomo. Good. You did the right thing. Good for you.
I still don't personally like you.
That's right. I should just tell people who are still listening to the program and are not members. Yesterday we had in a caller who used to frequently call into the program and was adamant about disliking me. We came to some, I guess, agreement on the call about my concerns about torture and the lack of accountability for torturers and President Obama's responsibility in that regard. And after telling us that he was surprised that we agreed, he did in the end say, but I still don't like you. And which I thought was
in a somewhat similar fashion to how
yes. And you know what? I think I thought it was fair when he said that to me. And that's why it's important to be honest. Like, I thought that was perfectly legitimate. And now it's like it's come back. That's what karma does. I can say that about Cuomo. So, Cuomo, thank you for banning fracking in New York State. I still do not like you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And we got plenty of stuff on the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, it is your memberships that make this show possible. And it is things like you going to iTunes, even if you don't download the show from iTunes. even if you're a member, even if you're not a member, even if this is the first time you've ever listened to the show and you're like, hey, you know, it would be, I think it's good that this show exists. Other people should listen to it. There is a no cost way of you promoting the show. And it literally takes 2 minutes. Head over to iTunes. Give us a good review. Give us a rating. That's the way that we move up in the, I don't know what their algorithm is, but it certainly involves part of that. I don't even know if I know what an algorithm is. Never mind what their algorithm is. I'm not even sure I know what the word algorithm means. But please go over there. Give us a review. Also, you can take it to the next level and become a member of the show, wherein you support the show by giving us about 33 cents a day to keep doing the work we're doing. I think just Michael's callback on that call from yesterday was worth almost 17, 18 cents right there. And then the stuff with Cuomo, that's another 5 cents, 6 cents. You probably could have picked it up somewhere else, but so we're already at 24 cents. We're not even halfway through the show yet. This could be a 48 cents worth show today.
And you would still get it for only 33.
Yeah. And then, I mean, think about that. If you're getting a 48 cent, maybe a 52 cent, sometimes we probably hit 57 cent. There's been a couple of times we've done a 65 cent valued show. But you're only paying 33 cents. You're going to start to make money. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. So let's say you want to make even more money on top of being a member on the show. You say to your friend, hey, I'm going to pick you up some Just Coffee. Just pay me back. They think you're getting it for retail. You're actually getting 10% off. There's another way to make some cash. And then if you buy crap from Amazon, if that's your habit already, you should, by all means, go to majoritycickback.com, click on the Amazon link, majoritycickback.com, couldn't be an easier URL to remember. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always go to that Amazon. If you're you're the type of person who buys stuff from Amazon, we get a kickback. All right, we're going to take a break.
Also, send in your best of 2014 suggestions, interviews. I think at this point we have plenty of interviews, but continue to send those. But what we really could use is some more segment.
We should put that request out on Twitter and on Facebook.
Send us your favorite Majority Report segments. Give us the show date, what you liked from it. It's easy to find the segments specifically on YouTube by just searching on our YouTube channel because each segment is clipped. So, best of 2014. Send in your best of interviews and segments.
All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. I'm going to head into the fun half. See you in a moment.